America and the world. This is Radio Free Market, and I am your host, Michael McKay. Along with me is our special commentator, Megan O'Toole. Hello, Megan. I know you're out there somewhere.
Yes.
We have a very special interview today, folks. Many of you who have listened to us regularly or go to our website at radiofreemarket.com know that our byline is that we are behind the lines of socialism, and that Radio Free Market is the voice of free people and free market. Well, today, we are very fortunate to have the voice of freedom who survived and escaped from behind the lines of socialism, Dr. Yuri Maltsev. Hello, Yuri.
Hello, Michael.
Well, welcome. You are most welcome. And we are very happy to have you with us today.
The pleasure is mine.
Oh, great. Thank you. So, Yuri, let me tell the listeners first that this is a call-in show, so please call in over the next hour at 1-800-313-9443. Let me give you that number again. That's 1-800-313-9443. We'll try to get you your question in front of Dr. Maltsev here. Second, I want all the listeners to know about Yuri Maltsev. Yuri is a senior fellow of the Mises Institute, and he worked as an economist on Mikhail Gorbachev's economic reform team in the late 1980s before defecting to the United States in 1989. He is the editor of Requiem for Marx, which I recommend all listeners to purchase and to read, an excellent book. And he teaches economics at Carthage College in Kenosha, Wisconsin. So, again, thank you so much for being with us today, Yuri, and helping us understand what it was really like to be in the Soviet Union in the 1980s. So, Yuri, you were a member of the Perestroika team of economists back in the late 1980s under Gorbachev, and even held the title of People's Deputy in Moscow from 1987 to 1989. You know, I'd like to start by, if you don't mind, asking you to tell our listeners what the word perestroika even means. Most of our listeners, I would venture guess, don't even know.
Oh, very good. Yes, perestroika. Perestroika in Russian, that means restructuring. Restructuring. What was actually meant? It was the last attempt to save socialism, because Soviet Union, I think, they very convincingly show the world that socialism does not work, because Soviet Union was the biggest country in the world. As economists today in Washington would say, it was definitely too big to fail, but it failed. It failed. It had 11 time zones. It had almost all possible and impossible natural resources. However, nothing worked because the system was the most idiotic, the most anti-human system, which was punishing initiative, which was punishing good work. And sure enough, the Soviet Union fell like a card house. So that was perestroika, so perestroika reforms initiated by Mikhail Gorbachev. He was elected as the General Secretary of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union on the glorious day of the 23rd of March, 1985, well, elected by 11 people, members of Politburo, not by masses. But he tried to introduce something, as he called socialism, with a human face. So perestroika was coupled by another kind of buzzword, which was glasnost. Glasnost, that means openness. Openness. Doesn't have anything to do with freedom of speech, but openness. That means that people could voice some of their concerns about economy, about corruption. Nothing could save already the corpse of socialism, corpse of socialism. And that was a tragedy for Mr. Gorbachev, that instead of scrapping this system, he was trying to reform it.
Okay, Yuri, I'm going to have to interrupt you now. We're going to be back right after a break. And so stay listening, folks. We're going to continue this fascinating conversation with Dr. Yuri Maltsev. Stay with us. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes.
Very good.
And we're back. This is Radio Free Market. This is Michael McKay, and I have today the distinct pleasure of interviewing Dr. Yuri Maltsev. Now, over the break, folks, Megan O'Toole, our special commentator, made a comment. I'm going to throw the ball to her because we were just talking about how the West had this positive impression of Mikhail Gorbachev during the 1980s. Megan, go ahead.
Well, I attended public middle school, and when I was in public middle school, my history teacher did speak well of Gorbachev from a historical perspective as a reformer, as someone who helped Russia transition out of degradation and poverty and starvation into a more healthy society, a more prosperous country economically. And
was that your experience there, Yuri?
Yes, Mr. Gorbachev, with all my due respect to him, he was a socialist. He liked socialism. That was his choice. And he tried to reform socialism. And in the process, what he did, he removed fear out of Soviet economic system because he was talking about socialism with a human face. So humane socialism, which to me sounded like an oxymoron. There cannot be such a thing.
Mm-hmm.
Because you can introduce socialism only by violence, by coercion, by making people to work for nothing. So socialism is another, it's a new form of slavery, of one set of people telling other set of people what to do. And Mr. Gorbachev, he had this pipe dream that you can remove fear out of socialism.
But did he really actually do that? I mean, what he did with the restrictions on alcohol were...
At first, when he became general secretary of the Communist Party, at first he came up, like all Communist Party bureaucrats, with the idea that people should be blamed. It's not the system. It's people. The same thing we hear right now from Washington, that we have un-American people who are attending all these tea parties, and they are boycotting these great reforms. And Gorbachev was, he couldn't say that because there were no tea parties in Russia. However, vodka parties were pretty common. Gorbachev was saying, People, bad people, they're drinking too much. Instead of listening to me, they are deliriously drunk. They cannot build socialism. And because of that, he removed the booze at first out of the system. And because for many people, that was, I think, the only way they could make peace with the Soviet system via booze. And then when booze was removed, so they became very, very irritated by Mr. Gorbachev. And then Mr. Gorbachev, by his talks, talking nonstop about socialism with human face, then I think there was a funny joke, if I may, it just will take maybe half a minute, that it was a CIA agent in Moscow, and CIA agent was going from one empty store to another, writing in his notebook that there is no bread in bakeries, there's no meat in butcheries, there's no books in bookstore, no shoes in shoe store. And the KGB guy looked over his shoulder and he said, 10 years ago, we would shoot you. And he wrote there, no bullets. And that was exactly, I think, the feeling of the people was that they ran out of bullets, so nobody would be shot. And as a response to this Gorbachev's talk about socialism with human face, everybody stopped working right away.
Yeah.
And then the system collapsed because there was nothing to work for. People were working because they were scared.
Right.
Because they could be fired, they could be evicted from their apartments, could be sent to Siberia. And under previous regimes like under Stalin or Khrushchev or Lenin, they could be shot.
You know, one of the things that I found very fascinating in researching this interview with you is that the Soviet government's budget began to lose, between $25 and $30 billion a year, in lost revenue from taxes for alcohol because they actually taxed it up to 6,000%. And,
yes.
You know, they estimated that when 90% of the liquor stores were forcibly closed, the sugar, the flour, the aftershave, the window cleaner immediately disappeared from the shelves, and 13,000 to 25,000 people were estimated to have died from drinking poisonous booze.
Absolutely.
And you tell a story, actually, about how they used to round up people who were drunk and carry them off into the country and make them walk back. How did that work?
Yes, in many cases, every Monday, they will have like a roll call on all the enterprises, just, and they would send home those who could not stand.
Okay.
Yes, the rate of absenteeism on Mondays were 40 to 50%.
Oh, my gosh.
People just could not collect themselves and bring themselves to work because of, and that was that was kind of definitely an excuse for the lazy and whatnot. However, it was the only, I think, the only admissible form of social protest in the Soviet Union. That people, their life was so grim, so gray, and when they would drink, they would kind of imagine themselves in their dream world. That was the only kind of illusion. That it's not freedom. It's illusion of freedom. But people were after that.
One of the things that is so obvious about socialist attempts is that they use a combination of mandates and restrictions and then mm-hmm. privileges to certain people. And the concept that Gorbachev came up with of dishonest income applied to people having a garden behind their house, renting out a room, if you didn't get an approval certificate to sell something, like you tell the story about the young man who raised the pig, you could have it confiscated or, you know, subject to bribery or whatever.
Yes, definitely. Definitely. By dishonest incomes in the Soviet Union, they meant people working for themselves, not
just regular jobs.
For the government,
but
doing things which are pretty legal everywhere else. Not even pretty legal, but pretty much highly esteemed things of helping others. And that was all prohibited. Besides that, not many people realized that not only honest work was prohibited, charity was prohibited. You couldn't help others. You couldn't, if for example, an Orthodox priest or minister of any other church, or synagogue or mosque would be seen talking to people or helping people outside the premises of his institution, then he would go to jail. He would go to Siberia because the priest could not even accompany dead people in funerals to the arrest. So that was completely insane regime. They tried to enforce monopoly on thought. That's why they hated religion. All religions were hated. They tolerated them just because to prevent public outcry. Most of religious leaders, say in Russian Orthodox Church, were and still are KGB agents who were implanted there by the government to control thought in church events.
You know, I've listened over time to so many of your stories, and one of the things that continues to come up is the concept that people were constantly paranoid as to who they were talking to. And you tell the story about a manufacturer who manufactured furniture, and when he denied a bribe that they demanded, a team of six accountants came into his office, combed through his records over a period of weeks, found a 34-ruble mistake, and as a result, he had to pay a $15,000 bribe. And can you just give that a perspective in dollars? 34 rubles, approximately how much then?
Well, it's because ruble was a completely inflated currency of former Soviet Union, so it's difficult to say. Officially, that would be about $30.
Okay.
But to tell the truth, nobody knew. I worked as in a bank in Soviet Union for a while, and I was a chief consultant of Bank for Foreign Trade. And we had a joke that what is the exchange rate between the ruble, the dollar, and the British pound? And the answer was that $1 cost 1 pound of dried rubles. now, however, things are changing. and we are competing. You know, we're debasing the currency with the whole
maybe
world.
We'll have some dried dollars that we can inflate later or reconstitute.
That's right, that's right. Now we are here printing money that there's no tomorrow.
Well, you know, you tell a story also about, you know, when all else was exhausted, Gorbachev began to speak about markets, planned, regulated socialist markets, and he tried to create huge budget cuts. But in fact, it was just a sleight of hand where he fired 600 bureaucrats, but then, you know, hired them back.
Absolutely, yes. Well, I mean, newspeak was all the time, and it is today now, because I think now center of Bolshevism moved from Moscow to Washington D.C. We can hear the same kind of newspeak. Instead of saying socialism, they're saying public option or cooperative option or something like that. And Gorbachev, when he was talking about capitalism, instead of saying market economy or something, he was talking about socialism. Socialist planned market economy, which just doesn't sounds like kind of a madman's idea. What does mean socialist market economy? It's an oxymoron, it's a contradiction in terms.
Well, let's talk about that more right after the break, folks. We are going to take a very brief break. We have Dr. Yuri Maltsev on Radio Free Market, and please call us at 1-800-313-9443 to get your question in. And we'll be back right after the break. Thank you for listening, and stay with us. And welcome back, everyone. This is Michael McKay. You're listening to Radio Free Market, and today we have Megan O'Toole, our special commentator, and we are interviewing Dr. Yuri Maltsev. So, Yuri, we've been just talking about the impossibility of economic calculation under a socialist system. Can you break it down for us? Why is it impossible to have economic calculation?
Because the impossibility of socialism itself, actually, impossibility of economic rationale, is based on the absence of property rights. Not many people realize that property rights, this is exactly what distinguishes between the prosperous and free countries and countries which are decimated by their own governments, completely destroyed places. Property rights is the most important right of a person. James Madison said that property rights are the mother of all rights. And when communists abolished property rights in 1917, then can you imagine that nobody owned anything? Everybody overnight was turned into a slave. And then, sure enough, byproduct of this slavery was complete absence of the market. So the market, the only market which existed was a black market, which was all the time exposed to government repressions and mass shootouts. Just for selling things in the black market, people could be killed, and many of them were. Millions of people were sent to Siberia just because they were trying to sell, for example, vegetables which they raised themselves, or some clothes which they made themselves. So this was the most insane thing. An impossibility, however, the theoretical impossibility of rational economic calculation under socialism is the absence of prices. If you don't have supply and demand schedule, you don't have anything which would resemble some kind of equilibrium price. And so if you don't have a price, then you need to come up with the price. How you can come up with the price in a country, you say, in the Soviet Union, which had more or less sophisticated economy with about 23 million different prices.
Mm.
And I remember I was on a panel with a deputy minister for prices in Soviet Union. They had a huge building in downtown Moscow where they would set, where the 600 bureaucrats would set 23 million prices. And the minister, because he was attacked by the people with all kind of questions because the prices were completely insane in the Soviet Union, the only thing he could say, he said, well, we have 23 million prices and only 600 people. So he probably wanted 23 million people to manage 23 million prices. But that was completely impossible to come up with the price. And if you don't have a rational price, then you allocate resources in the way which is wasteful. So Soviet Union was the first in waste. Even Lenin, mass murderer, Vladimir Ilyich Lenin, who was the founder of the Soviet Union, even he once told Politburo members, he said, when the whole world will become socialist, then we still need to keep one country, maybe a small country like Switzerland, capitalist country, and then we can look what kind of prices we should have.
Right. Because otherwise, you can't make those prices up just by accident. They have to find some reference point for prices.
Absolutely. Because what they did, at first they had something called social theory of pricing. That means that the goods which would be considered by bureaucrats would be considered to be good goods, for example, like children's food or formula, would be very cheap. Because of that, there was no formula at all, because it was so cheap. Then vodka, which was considered to be a kind of a sinful drink by all bureaucrats, even in the United States, then it was extremely expensive. So people were making moonshine and poisoning themselves. So this whole thing about economic calculation, it sounds like an academic talk, but it is very practical. It was extremely practical. It was the price system was distorting people's lives, distorting just almost everything. A lot of resources were wasted because bread, for example, was considered to be the most important food staple. Bread was so cheap that where bread was available, people would feed it to pigs. And where it would not be available, and in many cases would not be available because it was so cheap, people would buy a lot of it. Some people were making moonshine out of bread. So that's all the dislocations were based in the failure of economic system to perform properly. And that was, to tell the truth, it was not an economic system. It was just a very simple, primitive system of management. People were working because they were told so, because they were scared not to. Otherwise, there was absolutely no incentive to do anything.
Well, you know, many people, when the Soviet Union collapsed, said, well, that form of socialism didn't work. But maybe there's another form of socialism that can be made to work. Maybe they just didn't do it right.
Yes.
What do you say to that?
Yes. I met a lot of people and was at many conferences in which the advocates of socialism in the West, in the United States and in Europe, they would say, no, that was not a systems failure. That was a human error.
Okay. Well, we're going to talk more about that after the break, folks. Please stay with us. We have Dr. Yuri Maltsev on Radio Free Market. This is Michael McKay and Megan O'Toole, and we're going to be back right after the break. Please stay with us. It's going to be a very exciting next segment. We're going to talk about healthcare. Welcome back, folks. This is Michael McKay, and you're listening to Radio Free Market. And today we have Dr. Yuri Maltsev, and we have Megan O'Toole, our special commentator. And please call in with your questions at 1-800-313-9443. This is our long segment, so please call in with your questions, and we'll get to them. Yuri, we were just talking about the concept of a softer form of socialism, and I want to bring the conversation around to the healthcare debate that we're having currently here in the United States. There was an article this morning in Bloomberg that quoted the OECD that this concept of rationing and age discrimination is just baloney. It's not really what's happening. Can you comment about how rationing occurred in not just in the Soviet Union, but also in Great Britain and Canada, and why that isn't baloney, why we can expect rationing, why we can expect age discrimination as we move closer to a completely socialist or more socialist type system?
Well, it's obviously from point of view of just standard economics that if you don't have a price for something and people want it, then you need to ration it in some other way. And in many countries, I was recently in Mexico, I saw a very, very long line of people who are standing in line overnight to get an appointment with the doctor. This kind of rationing is called first come, first served. Rationing. Then it can be rationing which would be based on corruption, on extortion of bribes. For example, if you have something other people want, then you can sell it on the black market. And that was also very common in, and it is very common in countries with socialized medicine. Speaking about soft socialism, then another rationing definitely would be that people would, the first would be provided people whom a rationer, who the person who is doing the rationing, whom he likes. And that would be people in government, for example, or people who are his or her relatives, or people who look like them, people who can give kind of kickbacks to these people. And that was the case. Speaking about soft or hard version of socialism, I would agree that the more socialism you have, the worse it is. Say in Soviet Union, healthcare, system was atrocious, absolutely disgusting, and it had both first come first served basis, so people would wait a very long time in waiting rooms, they would be on wait lists for procedures and whatnot. The only way when I hear the talk that we need to save. Say in the United States, for example, how you can save, or anywhere else, you can only save by denying care, that means not giving people what they want, or squeezing producers. And in the United States, for me, the strange thing I hear is from medical profession, when the doctors and nurses do not realize what they're getting into, that today, medical professionals in the United States are the highest paid medical professionals in the world. In no other country, people are getting so much. And that's why we have an influx of Canadian and British and Australian doctors into the United States. And we have the cream of the crop of the medical profession of the world because we are paying them more than anywhere else. And the same very people are saying that we should have socialized medicine. Socialized medicine means that all these medical professions would become civil servants and would be paid accordingly by some wage-setting bureaucrats in Washington, D.C. So this is very strange that these people, that many of these people, I'm not saying all of them, but many of these people do not realize what they're heading for.
You mentioned that that's like the sheep demanding the wolf.
That's right. It is very, very sad, yes. Then another thing is that in Soviet Union, definitely the country which could be the richest country in the world, life expectancy, because of deplorable socialized healthcare system, was 57 for men and 66 for women. Even in today's Russia, after they privatized their socialized medicine, even today it's 58 for men, and it's 70 for women. So it is about 20 years shorter than what we have in the United States. So that kind of sounds like socialism doesn't work, so long live socialism. That's what we should have. And I'm not a masochist. I'm not at least a socioeconomic masochist. I don't think that the system, which proved itself to be a murderous system, the cost of socialism all over the world in the 20th century alone is about 170 million people, according to the famous demographer Rudy Rommel. Yes. And so this is in Soviet Union, 78%, I believe, of people with HIV virus got their virus from dirty needles and tainted blood in state-run hospitals. When I was a people's deputy, when Perestroika started, then they had some kind of people's participation in government. And I, unexpectedly for myself, was elected a people's deputy. And so I was dealing mostly with a lot of complaints by people, complaints about drunken doctors, about thieves in ambulance crews. Can you imagine a person would faint on the street, will be brought by ambulance to the hospital with his pockets emptied already.
Oh, my
goodness. So then, yeah. Then there were a lot of, I mean, there was also people don't realize that if you have socialized medicine, if medicine is run by government, then you cannot have a tort grievances. You cannot sue the government.
Right.
And then if you have a butcher instead of a surgeon, then there is absolutely no grievance mechanism for you to employ. So this
yeah,
is,
you told that story about the very unfortunate story of the 14-year-old girl from your district who died of acute nephritis.
Just because the doctor decided to save on X-ray film, that the film, which probably cost pennies, was saved, and the wonderful teenager, very nice to everybody. Everybody liked her a lot. Because there was a wrong diagnosis, which could be corrected by just using this X-ray film. She died, and sure enough, her grandparents, whom I also knew very well, they died within half a year because she was an apple in their eyes. And so this is, not only that, I have a friend, that's this story I never wrote anywhere. I had a friend, he came to Moscow from Kazan, Tatarstan, and he was mugged and robbed and beaten, and he was brought to the hospital. And I went to this hospital, and the doctor, nice young doctor, I thought very good, bright young man, he said he has a concussion, and also he has a crack in the base of his skull, and this is very bad, very bad trauma. So if he would die, nobody would look into this. And he needs all the attention that he deserves. And I was just thinking, what is he telling me? The doctor was telling me that he will kill my friend if he would not get a bribe. He was not saying that that he needs attention, whatever. He was telling me that nobody will look into that because statistically this trauma, crack in the base of the skull, results in a very high mortality. So nobody will look into why this person deceased. So you can see that this is atrocious. I'm not saying that in Canada is like this or in the United Kingdom. It is not, because they don't have as much socialism. However, the more you have, the worse it is. And we hear all kind of bad stories from United Kingdom, from Canada, from other Western European countries. In Sweden today, in Germany, a lot of people are talking about privatizing their medicine. And we are trying to get exactly where people don't want to be.
That's amazing. That's really amazing. Now, earlier during the break, Megan, you had made a comment. I cut you off earlier. Sorry.
Yeah, but
do you want to bring that out now?
Yeah, I just wanted to comment that I found it extremely ironic that here in the United States, after having seen the collapse of the Soviet Union and the destruction that socialized medicine has caused within the Soviet Union, I mean, there's just no denying it, after having seen that to an extreme, why is it that we're wanting to initiate even a small or light form of that into our country in the name of helping people or saving people from being without health care as though it's their mission on earth to save people's lives, and as though that will actually do that, when it's been proven the opposite, that it will not save people's lives, it will actually destroy them.
Absolutely, absolutely, Megan. And why bureaucrats, why government wants to take over medicine? It is obvious why. Because medicine is is healthcare is the most important for people. And if you control that, if you control, then you control energy, then you control everything else.
Mm-hmm.
And then the people would at a certain point would wake up and find themselves that they're slaves, that the government mm-hmm. is controlling their lives completely, life and death. I agree that the present system is very far from being perfect, and it should be reformed, but it should be reformed on completely not even different but opposite lines than what is suggested by Washington D.C. today. It is ridiculous that if markets work everywhere else, they denied efficiency in healthcare.
One of my favorite things I like to point out to people is the 30% reduction in costs in LASIK surgery, improvement of a successful LASIK surgery, because it is not covered by any insurance. It is a cash business. It's directly a relationship between the consumer and the doctor.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the closest thing that we have right now to a direct example of how actually a medical service can improve in quality and decrease in price at the same time, which is the natural result of more free markets.
Absolutely, absolutely, yes. And definitely, even steps in that direction, like health savings accounts, for example, combined with catastrophic insurance or whatnot, that would be steps in the right direction. I think that of unfreezing the healthcare system, which today is based on the completely economically insane third-party PE system, when people are not price-sensitive at all. Prices, that's what regulate economy. Prices, that's what makes economy efficient. But we don't have prices in medicine. I mean, nobody cares about these prices. There's no competition practically. The government imposed special mandates that even insurance companies cannot compete with each other if they're in different states.
Right.
So, This is something which is called medical need, or others, that which provides central planners from Washington D.C. a lot of power already on our healthcare system, and government is already paying over half of healthcare expenditures through Medicare, Medicaid, Veterans Affairs Hospitals, Bureau of Indian Affairs. No, like that. But from another, and now they are saying, well, look, free market screwed up medicine, like it was there. No, the free market, I think, was expunged from medicine immediately after the Second World War.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Well, you know, we went through this in a show we had a couple of weeks ago where we discussed that it was Harry Truman that at first proposed the concept of Medicare in 1945, and then he was the first one to sign up for it in 1965.
Mm-hmm.
And Nixon was the one that imposed the HMO legislation, or introduced it, I should say.
Yeah, with the help of Ted Kennedy. Huh?
Yes, exactly. And as a result of that, the mandates and restriction process became accelerated, and that brought in, of course, the lawyers, and the lawsuits, and liabilities for not complying with the various new rules, and the spiral of additional costs increased. And we saw that going on. I brought out the point last show, or that show with Jake Towne, that's available on our website for free viewing or listening download, that there are 1,300 different insurance companies in the United States that provide health insurance, but they are, as you said, Yuri, they're not allowed to actually compete across state lines.
Mm-hmm.
And so if they do want to actually compete in different states, that they have to create, basically, if they wanted to compete in 50 different states, that's 50 different risk pools, 50 different sets of rules and laws, compliance methods, procedures, and so on. And, right there, you can see the enormous additional cost overhead that they have to pay. And so, it goes on from there. I wanted to actually take the conversation back to this topic that is getting so much airtime right now about age discrimination. And you mentioned that there's this you know, everybody knows that the chief of staff under President Obama's White House is Rahm Emanuel. Many people do not know that his brother, Ezekiel Emanuel, is the director of the Clinical Bioethics Department of the U.S. National Institute of Health and is a principal architect of President Obama's health care reform. And in an article that you cite, Yuri, in the medical journal The Lancet in January 2009, I wanted to read this, that he says that unlike allocation of health care by race or sex, allocation by age is not invidious discrimination. Every person lives through different life stages rather than being a single age. Even if 25-year-olds receive priority over 65-year-olds, everyone who is 65-year-olds now was previously 25 years. Treating 65-year-olds differently because of stereotypes or falsehood would be ageist. Treating them differently because they have already had more life years is not. I can't
believe it. Absolutely. I want to give another quote from the same author,
okay,
from Ezekiel Emanuel. And he wrote that health services should not be guaranteed to individuals who are irreversibly prevented from being or becoming participating citizens. Participating citizens, that means active taxpayers. That means active workers. And that would rule in everybody who is over 65.
Oh, boy.
So well, that means that why should we guarantee, his point is, the individuals who cannot take care of themselves.
All right, we'll be right back after the break, folks. Our last segment is coming up. Stay with us. This is Radio Free Market. And we're back. This is Radio Free Market, and we're talking to Dr. Yuri Maltsev. And we have a caller, Vicki, from Idaho. Vicki, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Yes.
I've been listening to this discussion, and the thing that you always, you people who promote the idea of a totally free market in the healthcare field, the thing that you always ignore is the fact that medical care is not optional. You can't go shop for medical treatment like you can go shop for a tire. Because if you buy a bad tire, big deal, you can just, you know, go buy another one. You cannot go buy yourself a new body. And, you know, so in the field of healthcare, you have to have a mediated market.
Well, let's address this issue. And thank you very much, Vicki. That's an excellent topic. We're going to discuss that next.
Okay.
Thank you. So I think her point is very valid. You know, there is you can't go out and shop. Why can't we go out and shop?
I would say if I have a choice between tires and health, I would definitely, in making choices in competition, I would definitely prefer to go into competitive health system rather than competitive tire system.
Right.
Because choice, competition, is the only way to keep the system good. Because, say, in Soviet Union or any other socialized healthcare system, you cannot have a choice in healthcare. What does this mean? That means that if a doctor, you'll be assigned to a doctor, the same way as children are assigned to public schools. They cannot go to the school they want, a public school. They would only go to the school of their zip code, where they belong, according to bureaucrats. The same thing. It will be the same, like unified public school system. It would be the same unified medical districts. And you can only go to the doctor which was assigned to you, because how the state would have a doctor, for example, nobody wants, and how you can force people to go there. You can only force them through socialized medical system.
Right. What I would add to this is that she made the point that it must be mediated. The fact is that she makes also another interesting point that's also valid, that it has to be mediated, but how is it mediated? It's mediated by price. The reason that it can't be mediated by price right now is because doctors are not allowed to actually quote you what different procedures would cost. And frankly, it's too convoluted a system anyway, because they're paid different amounts by different insurance companies.
Yes.
But you can't even call a variety of doctors and say, how much would it cost me to have my knee fixed? You know, because they can't really tell you.
Right. And think of, just before the break, I was giving a quote from Ezekiel Emanuel, the architect of the new healthcare system. And I just want to continue with this quote because I didn't have a chance to give the full quote.
He said
that services should not be guaranteed to citizens who are irreversibly prevented from being productive citizens. An obvious example, writes Mr. Emanuel, is not guaranteeing health services to patients with dementia. So that means that patients with dementia should not have any access to healthcare system, and this patients it's in a much worse situation than to deny them tires. And besides that, I think I also want to mention there's a wonderful movie on the internet, and you can purchase it or you can just watch it on the internet, called The Soviet Story, about the results of communism in Soviet Union. And they have an interview with a famous socialist, George Bernard Shaw, very famous British playwright. And Mr. Shaw is saying, we know about people who cannot justify their existence. We should get rid of them. I pray that scientists would come up with some humane gas, and we'll gas this, put them into eternal sleep. This is the outcome. It's not that...
Right.
Yes, so this is
where socialistic medicine leads. Well, folks, thank you very much for listening.